Hello, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Hope for Healthcare with Dr. Katie Cole. Dr. Katie Cole is a holistic physician, organizational well-being consultant, and change agent, working with industry leaders in proven strategies to heal our national healthcare system and our culture of medicine. Stay tuned to hear today's speaker.
Well, welcome everyone to Hope for Healthcare. This is a podcast in which we interview expert leaders around the country on best practices for healing our national healthcare system and culture of medicine. I want to extend a very warm welcome to my friend and colleague, Dr. Tom Mayer, and we are so grateful that he is a repeat guest on the podcast today. Dr. Mayer is the medical director for the NFL Players Association. He is Executive VP of Leadership for Logix Health, founder of Best Practices, Inc., Speaker of Executive Speakers Bureau, Clinical Professor of Emergency Medicine at George Washington University, and Senior Lecturing Fellow at Duke. He was named the 2018 winner of the James D. Mills Outstanding Contribution to Emergency Medicine Award, which is the highest honor of American College of Emergency Physicians. He was recently nominated also to the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton, Ohio. USA Today has named him one of the most important people in the NFL, and Tom Peters, the internationally acclaimed leadership guru, has referred to his work as gasp-worthy. Battling Healthcare Burnout, a previous book won the ACHE's James Hamilton Award for the Best Healthcare Leadership Book in 2022, and Leadership for Smooth Patient Flow also won the James Hamilton Award for Leadership back in 2008. Most recently, Dr. Mayer is publishing his new book, Leadership is Worthless, but Leading is Priceless, What I Learned from 9/11, the NFL, and Ukraine. So today we're going to delve into his book and find out, you know, his new strategies for becoming the best leader. So thank you so much for being here today, Tom.
Well, Katie, thanks for having me on. It's a real honor, as always, and I appreciate very much the chance to learn from you.
Absolutely. Well, you know, what I love actually in your introduction with your book is that you really talk about that this is not a leadership book, but rather it is a book about calling for a redefinition of leadership and leading to transform us into the focus on the present and multiple acts through which us all lead. Can you talk to us a little bit about why you wanted to redefine leadership today?
Sure. I think that when you think about leadership, and the title is probably either not clever enough or too clever by half, but the insight is that leadership is a noun. It's just something you say, and anyone can say anything. I think we've been suffering from that people have equated and conflated saying something with doing something. But leading is a verb. It's something that you do all day, every day. And that takes you to a corollary, which is a critical corollary, which is leadership is not the people above us. It's all of us, no matter what we do, whether you're a physician, whether you're a nurse, whether you're a healthcare administrator, whether you're a waitress, whether you're a chef, whether you're a restaurant owner, doesn't matter. It's not something above us. So what that means is that the answers are not above us. They're within and among us in the organizations and in our lives and our families as well. There's over 60,000 books on Amazon alone with leadership in the title. And when I speak to an audience, I ask them, how many of you read a leadership book in the last year? Of course, everyone raises their hands. And then I say, tell me what it said. Blank stares, you know. And I think that's not a criticism of the books that are out there. It's trying to help people realize that this is about us. This is about all of us.
Absolutely. And I really love how you have a continuous theme through your books where you talk about the importance of being a good leader, not only for yourself, but for your family, your friends, and your team and your professional life. Because I think that however we show up professionally is also how we show up personally as well.
Well, I agree. I mean, I think it's... And I was shocked with people like Coach K from Duke and the fulsome praise he gave Senator Mark Warner. Each person picks up on something a little differently. Coach K picked up on the fact that it's about all of us leading all day, every day, and not about hierarchy and organizations. Mark, I picked up on making failure your fuel, which is, as you know, is one of the chapters. So I hope that's true of everyone. By the way, I called both of them after I read their quotes and said, are you sure you read the right book? I'm not sure. Maybe you gave this quote about some other book, but nonetheless, I appreciate both of those men a great deal.
Absolutely. Well, you give a lot of examples, even personal examples throughout your book around how you learn that the leader that you are looking for is you. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. I think that that insight is critical because, as you know, one of the things that many things are at least contrarian and some probably, hopefully, controversial. For example, I think that if you call someone a future leader, that is a toxic, demeaning, demoralizing, satanic way to refer to someone, as if I'm a leader, but you're not. I'm worthy, but you're not. I've risen to the heights of titles in the organization. And a title doesn't tell you who you are. It tells you your location. That's it. And so changing that so that we all realize that we're all leaders now, number one, but all of us, I'm okay with emerging leaders, developing leaders, learning leaders, but future leaders is just not something that we should be saying to other people.
Oh, absolutely. I really like that you brought that point up too, because I can't tell you how many times, especially when I was right out of residency and a young attending, I was told, oh, you know, someday, you know, you'll be a really good medical director, or you'll be a good leader someday. I was told that a lot. So I'm really glad that you're redefining that language.
Well, I'm not surprised knowing you that they said that. I'm also not surprised that the organizational structure, because it's medicine, as you know, and when I say medicine, I mean nursing, the entire healthcare organizations are highly hierarchical and therefore highly toxic, in my opinion. And, you know, flatter organizations, the ability to understand that the talent is the people who are at the bedside doing the work, regardless of what they do. The talent are the people who are involved with us. As you know, in healthcare, we call lab, x-ray, environmental services. And I ask my audiences, fill in the blank. They are blank services. And everyone shrugs and says, ancillary. Well, as you know, the term ancillary comes from the Latin anquila, which means female slave.
Oh, wow.
Seriously?
Oh, my
God. Serious? You know, they're not ancillary services. They're essential services. And they're leading just as much as we are in the course of the day. And that's true whether you're in a banker, whether you're in investment banking, whether I spoke last week to the Association for High Technology Distribution. And was very gratified by them saying back to me in their emails and after the talk itself, you know, that was really impressive that you were able to take that idea, leadership is worthless, but leading is priceless, and drive it down to what we do every day. Mm-hmm. But it's a human endeavor. It's a common endeavor to all of us. So I think we just have to be sensitive to that and careful about that. And as you know, it's often attributed to a different person, but the saying that be kind for everyone is fighting a great battle. That actually came from, in all likelihood, from Reverend Watson in the 18th century, but it's attributed to all kinds of Greek and Latin scholars. But that's true. We do need to be kind because everyone is fighting the great battle of leading in times of crisis through which they go through.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you say the leader that you're looking for is you, you know, I actually work on that with my physicians that I've coached in the past as well. It's a lot of physicians right now on the front line are just feeling really disempowered because they're, you know, they've got layer after layer of management and bosses and they don't know how to become a leader on the front line because some of that autonomy has been taken away. Do you have any like words of wisdom around that? Like
Oh, sure. First of all, the way we're working isn't working. How do we know that? in my specialty of emergency medicine, burnout rates are 63%. Wow. Emergency nurses about 50%. We've talked, and you've done such a great job of accentuating burnout. And so if that's the case, the way we're working isn't working. You know, what if we had a sign right above the healthcare system that said, you know, by the way, warning, half the people in this building are burned out, you know, come on in at your own risk. Well, I don't know that that would help brand our organizations the way they should be, but that's how we feel about it. So we have to change the way we're working. Mm-hmm. Doing that makes people uncomfortable because what you're saying is, oh by the way, boss, and by the way, the boss is someone who thinks they're the most important person in the room, whereas the leader is someone who knows that it's their job to make everyone else feel that they're the most important person in the room. Mm-hmm. So that becomes, it has some corollaries which are going to make people uncomfortable. For example, it's not the C-suite that matters, it's the we suite, mm-hmm. people who do the work. How are we going to redesign the work that we have? Well, the people who do the work, it's incumbent upon them to redesign how the work, because they know how it's not working. And the answer, for example, is not the words on the walls, it's the happenings in the halls. If I see a sign that says patient first, and I've got people waiting hours to see me, if I've got boarders waiting days to get a bed in the hospital, that doesn't look like the words on the walls, it's the happenings in the halls that matter. And perhaps most controversial, and I think I first learned this, but then it's been foot stomped, to use the term, over and over in my career. I think I first learned it at the Pentagon, which is, you know, it's time to stop sucking up. It's time to start sucking down. Mm-hmm. You know, I was at the Pentagon as a command physician. There are lots of great generals who are, you know, deeply emotional about their men, their women that were in that burning building. But they didn't have the answers. The people who had the answers were the structural engineers, the paramedics, the firefighters, because we can't go in and find people unless the building is structurally safe for us to do that. So, and I think that's true throughout our organization. You know, if you wanted to know about my emergency department, you'd probably learn a whole lot more from talking to somebody in environmental services than the C-suite. No offense to the C-suite. It's just that the job that we've associated with their responsibilities, in my opinion, is a different job than is the true reality of what they face.
Absolutely. And so I think physicians are beginning to understand that concept. Like, I think I'm still shocked when I do talk to a physician today that still is like, wow, really? Burnout is a thing. It's not my fault, you know? So we're told over and over that, you know, we're so used to having to take responsibility for everything as a physician that, you know, we take responsibility for a workflow not happening properly and everything. So how does a physician on the front line learn to become a little more empowered? And what's one action they can take today to change their circumstances?
Well, it sounds trite, but it's not intended to be. And that the one thing is lead. Understand that you are leading. You know, it's not, you don't have to go seek it. It's there. You're mm-hmm. taking care of folks. You know, we're on the front lines. If you're a radiologist, you're still taking care of folks. You're just taking care of folks through the images that you have of them. And you're making a difference in people's lives. So, you know, lead from the front, lead today, and make sure that your leading is priceless by leaving a legacy. The legacy is what, you know, it's not your insurance policies or the property you leave your kids. It's the it's your interaction, not just with the patients and their families, but your other colleagues, your nurses, you know, the other essential services people with whom we work all day, every day. And that way you don't have to ask permission. You don't even have to ask forgiveness. You just make a statement, a declarative statement that when you wake up and swing your legs out of the bed and plant your feet firmly on terra firma, you say, I will lead today. You know, how will I be leading today? One of the greatest leaders of all time said, leadership is not a question of what to do, but how to be. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, her name was Frances Hasselbein, who, as you probably know, was the CEO of Girl Scouts of America. You know, again, one of the greatest statements, one of the greatest leaders. And so what I've tried to do, as you can tell, is, you know, flavor the stories that I've told with the insights of great leaders, men and women, who have understood what they are the ones who are leading. And their job, let's say, as the C-suite, is not to solve all the problems, certainly not to blame all the problems on the people doing that job, but to create a milieu, to create a catalytic reaction among the people doing the work for them to be able to say, how do we, when we talk about hardwiring flow, you and I have talked about that before. What does that mean? Number one, stop doing stupid stuff. Number two, start doing smart stuff. Well, the C-suite can do that, but they're going to screw it up. I've been in the C-suite a good bit of my entire career because we don't know the work. We don't do the work. So the idea is, how do we create this catalytic reaction among the people doing the work that it's not just okay to say, this is stupid stuff, let's stop doing that. This is smart stuff. These are better ways in which it could be done. It's not just okay, it's their responsibility. It's, you know, let me tap into your creativity. Let me tap into your innovation. As you know, innovation does not occur at the speed of genius.
No.
It occurs at the speed of trust.
Absolutely. You know, one of the concepts that you talk about in your book is really, you mentioned growth mindset throughout in many different ways. One way is that you say, act in a week on your ideas and thoughts as a leader. And I think that is actually really relevant. And that's what I've always tried to do myself, is have an action plan. And I always try to tell my physicians, you know, what the plan is and what I'm working on behind the scenes and my goals, like in this, you know, at this date, this is going to be accomplished. Can you elaborate a little bit more on why it's so important to act, you know, within a
week? Sure. I mean, one of the things that that I've said is, don't aspire to be a leader. You already are a leader. Mm-hmm. Number two, you know, embrace the fact that you're a leader. Embrace the fact that, you know, you are not just the actor, but the problem solver. And then third, inspire other people, everyone around you, whether it's your family, your kids, your husband, your wife, your significant other, inspire them to understand that they're leading. Which leads you to a second set of three issues, which is think, act, and innovate. Mm-hmm. Think about leading in a radically different way. That's probably the central request of the reader, is to say, think about it in a different way. Number two, to act on those in a week, because if we don't do it within a week, we're not going to do it. And why is that? Not that we're bad people. That's the nature, human nature, of all of us. Mm-hmm. So when people listen to your podcast, which I love, by the way, I've listened, I think, all of them.
Thank you.
Helps me think about how to act. Then people say, well, how do I do that? And my answer is very simple. As you know, things are not all that bright. Things have to be very binary for me. Mm-hmm. So if I'm going to act within a week, how do I do that? Number one, look backward and look forward. Look backward by thinking about what it is that I'm thinking differently, and think, how could I have done that differently yesterday or the day before or whatever point in your life? Hey, Tom, how do I pick those out? What are the things that wake you up, that keep you up? What are the things that you regret? Those are the areas where you'd say, okay, I'm going to look back and say, next time I'm going to do the following. So you're ready for it. Then look forward. And that is to say, this is what I learned from thinking in a radically different way. And today, when I encounter this issue, this is how I'm going to react to that. And I think that takes you a long way. And then the third piece, of course, is to innovate. Think, act, and innovate. Why? Because the way we're working isn't working. And, I mentioned in the book, as you recall, that I talked about this a little bit with Chesley Sullenberger, Sully Sullenberger, Miracle on the Hudson. We were fortunate enough to have dinner with them in Wyoming, in our home in Wyoming. And I was talking to he and his wife, and she asked me, you know, what's your central thesis? And I said, well, you're not really a leader until you're in times of crisis. Leading occurs in times of crisis. And she laughed and said, you've been talking to Sully. And I said, actually, no, this is the first time we've met. And his answer, he laughed and said, well, I always say, you're not really a pilot until the engines go silent.
Wow.
What are you until then? Just a driver, he said. You know, very expensive, very well-trained driver, but you're just a driver until the engines go silent. And I think that's true of what he went through. It's true of all of us, you know. And you say, well, then I'm only going to lead once in a while. No, our whole lives are crisis now. Didn't take the coronavirus, SARS, to tell us what that's the case. But it did give us an epiphanous understanding of, oh, yeah, it's crisis all the time.
Mm-hmm. And so you talk about innovation occurs at the speed of trust. And I know we have a huge trust breakdown, and not even just in healthcare. We have an epidemic globally at the workplace with trust breakdown and community breakdown. Can you talk a little bit about how you really work to build trust with your own teams?
Sure. First of all, when organizations ask me to come on site and talk about innovation, I say, what's the success of your innovations? 92%, 95%. They're very proud of this. And my answer is, you know what? Cancel the flight. It's not worth your time for me to come on site, because if 92 to 95% of your innovations are successful, you're not innovating. You're just adopting best practices a little earlier than the lady down the street, than the guy around the block. You know, innovation requires thinking anew, acting anew, as Lincoln said, and being unafraid to be wrong, mm-hmm. or to not be completely successful in that innovation. That can only occur in the spirit of trust, where people feel it's okay to come up with crazy ideas. It's not just okay, it's necessary. And it's essential, because we're going to stop doing stupid stuff. We're going to start doing smart stuff. Who knows that stuff? You. The leader you're looking for is you. And then the trust occurs, I think, breakdowns in trust. Old saw, which is that how long does trust take to develop? Forever. How long does it take to break? And in microsecond. And that's unfortunately true. But it doesn't mean that we can't continue to trust. It means that anytime we break a trust, we have to start immediately to rebuild that trust. So very simple example. Somebody comes up with an idea about a system or a process that we're talking about, and the boss, most important person in the room in their mind, says, where'd you come up with that one? And you know, in medicine, we've, as residents, as junior faculty members, that happens all the time. Maybe not as dramatically as I put it. Mm-hmm. Instead of, wow, that's a really interesting idea. Tell me more about that. You know, what about this? How would you handle this problem or that problem? Because innovation at the speed of trust is tightly linked to making failure your fuel. Because, you know, that's essential, the ability to not regret failure. You know, Mandela said, you know, I never lose. I either win or I learn, but I never lose, because in each failure are the seeds of success. Abby Wambach, my friend, I've been on the dais with her a couple times, as this wonderful Barnard College commencement speech, which I highly recommend people link to. Mm-hmm. And one of the four things she stresses is make failure your fuel. Mm-hmm. You have to make failure your fuel. Whether you're an NFL player like my guys, they spend seven times as much time in the film room as they do on the practice field or a game. They're analyzing. And you know what? I never hear them say, wow, look at me. Wasn't I great? Look at that catch. Look at that throw. Look at that tackle. You know, they say, oh, you know, I could have done better here. Could have done better there. How could we have done things differently? And so I think the part of that trust is as individuals, but also as teams of people, that ability to analyze, here's what happened. Here's what we wish had happened. What's the delta between the two? And what are we going to do next time? Which, frankly, our son, as you may recall, Maureen and I's son, Kevin, was a Marine infantry officer. That's called an after-action review. After every patrol he went on in Afghanistan, they did an AAR and asked basically the questions I just said. So being able to do that, it requires understanding we have to make failure our fuel, and we can only innovate at the speed of trust.
Mm-hmm. Well, I like how you say we have to develop our failure muscles. I really like that, because it takes training. It's a completely different way of thinking and approaching how we lead.
As you know, there's a bunch of them, 11 total. But, you know, one of them I learned, of course, is just eliminate if only and but. Mm-hmm. And I tell that story of Jackie Smith. People say, I don't know who Jackie Smith is. Well, kid from Louisiana, and was it freshman year, he was going to play football, and he ended up having a severe injury. He couldn't play football. You know, he could have said, well, I would have been a great football player, but he came back, you know, his next year, wanted to play football, had another injury, this time a hip injury, couldn't play football. You know, if only I hadn't had an injury, you know, I would have been great, but he didn't do that. He came back and finally was able to play football. It turns out he was a great track athlete, and he got a scholarship to Northeastern Louisiana State University, but it was a partial scholarship. And they said to him, you know, Jackie, if you'll just go out for the football team, you don't have to make it and you don't even have to play. But if you just go out for the football team, we'll give you a full scholarship. So he did. Well, fast forward, played 16 years in the National Football League and is one of 386 men in the Hall of Fame in Canton, Ohio. He never said, if only. He never said, but. And so that's an example, I think, of how, yes, we have to make failure our fuel, but we're not going to dwell in it. We're not going to be resentful about our failures or those we think caused or had a role in our failures. Mandela, again, said, resentment is like drinking poison and hoping it will kill your enemy. Mm-hmm. Love that metaphor.
I love that metaphor.
It's doing nothing but hurting ourselves.
Well, and it holds us back too, because we're stuck in the past. We're ruminating over, you know, what we should have done differently. And instead of using that energy to apply how we can be different today. And
Absolutely.
I'm really big on, you know, energy and where we put our energy daily, and really practicing a growth mindset every day. And it takes practice. And I think that's why I really liked your phrase, you know, developing our failure muscles, because it's not looking at failure necessarily as a negative thing, because the most successful people in the world, time after time, have failed many, many times. Even Edison failed how many times, like, over?
Oh, yeah. He famously said, I didn't invent the incandescent light bulb. I invented 1,000 ways not
to invent the
incandescent light bulb. And, you know, I think that's just an essential verity, so that we need to learn how to celebrate that. Bill Belichick was very smart when, you know, part of his Patriot way, whether you like Belichick or the Patriots or not, is he said, you know, talent sets the floor of a team, but character sets the ceiling of a team. Part of that character is making failure your fuel, developing your failure muscles in a way to say, how are we going to turn adversity, a crisis, into an opportunity that's a benefit not just to us, but to those we serve, whether those we serve are our patients, whether it's those we serve are our clients as private equity companies, as waitresses, as mothers and fathers, whatever setting you're in. But it's really both for the benefit of serving others, because in serving others, we serve ourselves.
Absolutely. I really like that. Well, there was something else that you had mentioned in your book that I really wanted to call attention to. And you talk about, you know, leading by maintaining is exhausting, and innovation is the cure for that. And I know we touched on that briefly, but I really see that as being a key source of burnout for not only physicians, but executive healthcare leaders too, because they're trying to maintain a system that is no longer working. And I think innovation comes in to help us rebuild a new parallel system that can eventually transition over to a healthier foundation. I just wanted to get your input on that.
Yeah, Lou Holtz, I used to speak with Lou Holtz. I was sort of the warm-up act for Coach Holtz, won a national championship at Notre Dame. And after winning a national championship, I mean, essentially, he had a job for life if he chose to do that. And as a fervent Catholic, coaching it, as he calls it, the University of Notre Dame, was a lifelong dream. And then he gets there, he wins a national championship, and he resigns. And I said, Coach, why'd you resign? And as you know, he came back and coached in South Carolina after that. And he said, you know, Doc, I thought I was tired of coaching. He said, actually, I was tired of maintaining, mm-hmm. just staying at the same level. It was exhausting. It wasn't challenging to me. It drained my energy. And I think that's all of us, because if we go in, we have this job, which number one, burning out half of us, let's say over half in some circumstances. Number two, it's been a source of shame in the past to admit that you had burnout instead of saying, yeah, you know, why? Well, the job stressors exceed our adaptive capacity. We got to change the job stressors. So if you then say to that person, you have to maintain, you got to keep doing exactly what you're doing, the way you're doing it, with the toll extracted vastly exceeding the benefits enacted to you in doing that work. So, this is like Dante's Inner Circles. You know, you're condemning me to a profession of whatever type it might be, endlessly repeating the same things that have happened before. But if you say the way we're working isn't working, that innovation occurs at the speed of trust, we have to make failure our fuel, let's not maintain, let's innovate, let's find ways. And the only way we can do that in as a family, as an organization, as a team, is for all of us to be able to come up with our crazy ideas and say, how could it be done differently? And how would that benefit both the people we serve and the people who do the service to those folks over time? What does that do? Well, as you know, it creates hope. And if we need one thing, it's hope.
Oh, yes.
Meaning hope that things do, it's right behind you. Hope for healthcare, hope for life. You know, and what all that does, you know, a series of really simple steps, you suddenly go, that creates hope. Because it doesn't have to be this way. And it says in finding that hope, we're going to enlist you. We're going to ask you, because the leader you're looking for is you. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yes. It definitely does. And, you know, I like how you also talk about, you know, the importance of finding your deep joy and how that is so intricately connected to your alignment in your work and your ability to authentically lead when you have joy in the work that you're doing.
Well, I think that's critical. When our boys were younger, I used to take them to school. We had three boys, now young men. But when I dropped them off at school every day, I'd say the same thing. One more step in the journey of discovering where your deep joy intersects the world's deep needs. I swear I said this to them. They prefer to take the bus, as you might guess. They don't want to hear that from their dad. But my point is, don't start with the world's deep needs. Don't start with someone else's deep joy, because first of all, the world's deep needs are unfathomable and they are infinite. Mm-hmm. There are hundreds of thousands of ways to say this is, we need this, we need that. Do we need a teacher? Yes. Do we need a doctor? Yes. Do we need a nurse? Yes. Do we need a banker? Yes. Do we need, you know, a chef? Yes. Do we need a waitress? Yes. All those things are yes. Start with your deep joy, because that is what you need. That's the fuel you need to be able to fail, to be able to innovate, to be able to stay true, because we all are leading in times of crisis. So burnout, of course, just becomes the inability to feel your deep joy, the inability to feel, hey, this is why I came, to serve others, and then fill in the blank on how they get served. So, you know, the deep joy concept, you know, kind of goes through every chapter and every example, because that's where we stand.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, I think it's important to, I know when you're kind of in that stage of burnout or you're feeling like you're just maintaining status quo, sometimes you need to just take a step back and take some space to find, you know, what really brought you into medicine or what really brought you into the work that you're doing in the world and kind of rediscover where that joy is and try to bring it into your work every day. So
yeah, and there's a couple ways to do that, at least, because people always ask me, give me a tool, give me something practical. And that is to say, you feel like you're burned out. First of all, admit it. First of all, to yourself. You know, then to others, those you love, those you work with, but then say, well, how do I recapture that? And there's a couple of ways to do that. One is write a letter from yourself, to your previous self, to the self that said, this is my deep joy. I want to go into medicine. I want to go into banking. I want to go into investment banking. I want to own a restaurant. and write a letter to say, this is how you felt. This is why you came where you came. This is why you suffered through what you did. This is why you went through the failures and the struggles to get where you are. You know, how do you find your way back? And then tell them, this is how I'm going to find my way back. If some people like visuals more, get a picture of yourself and look at that previous self and say, you know, this was your deep joy. This is what you loved. This is why you went through everything that you went through. So there's a couple ways to do it, but it really involves that inner reflection of being able to grow and to learn and to have hope to be able to say, yes, it's gone wrong, but I can get it back right again.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that tool, Tom. I actually believe in journaling and in writing to our previous selves as well. I think it's a great technique.
Well, as you know, one of the greatest books of all time, Meditations by Marcus Aurelius, is not a book. It's his journal. He wasn't writing it thinking that anyone was ever going to read it. It's his journals. So journaling, I think, particularly in the business of coaching, is a critical tool.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I know we've kind of, I think that we have delved into quite a few topics and I've reviewed at least the highlights I have from your book. Are there any key messages that you want to leave with our audience today that we haven't already highlighted?
Yeah, I think it's a message of hope. And I'm not saying that because it's the name of the podcast. And hope not just for healthcare, but everyone that healthcare impacts, which is all those, you know, chefs and waitresses and investment bankers and teachers and all the other folks that we deal with, because it doesn't have to be this way. And because there's no reason to continue to tolerate it. I tell the story of, you know, Oppenheimer, the great movie, did us a great service because it rekindled that understanding that in the late 40s and 50s, physics and physicists were what biotech is now, the cutting edge of science. This is where the Nobel Prizes were being won. And in the summer of 1958, there was a gathering at Columbia University. All the greatest physicists in the world were there, with two exceptions, Oppenheimer and Einstein. Einstein was at Princeton that day, and Oppenheimer, of course, was tied down with the travails that are chronicled in the movie. But Wolfgang Pauli got up and gave a presentation on a unified field theory. And the unified field theory takes Newtonian mechanics, quantum mechanics, special theory of relativity, general theory of relativity, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, all the concepts, and ties them up into one ball. He sits down and the discussant, Niels Bohr, played in the movie by the great Kenneth Branagh, but the most revered next to Oppenheimer and Einstein, scientist or physicist in the world, stands and looks at Bohr and says to Bohr and to the whole audience, "We all agree that your theory is crazy. The question which divides us, is it crazy enough?" And so my question to your audience is, are you crazy enough? Are you crazy enough to say it doesn't have to be this way? Are you crazy enough to say, I'm not going to let anything get in the way of my pursuit of my deep joy? Are you crazy enough to say the way we're working isn't working? Are you crazy enough to say, you know, we're going to stop doing stupid stuff, we're going to start doing smart stuff? Are you crazy enough to say the leader you're looking for is you? Because my point is, if you're not, go get crazy. So I would say to your audience, go get crazy.
And I guess I would have to agree with that. Even as a psychiatrist, I would have to say, go get crazy, because it's, you know, that's part of a deep part of who we are and who we actually were, even as children and young adults. And that's how we were in our 20s and 30s when we were going through training, and we had all this hope and excitement for the future and what could be. And so it's tapping into that, it's tapping into that energy again.
Absolutely.
Love it. Well, Tom, it has been a complete honor to have you on the podcast today and highlight your new book. And for everyone listening, I'll have all this information posted, but please order his book, Leadership is Worthless, but Leading is Priceless. It's amazing. There are some new concepts in here that I learned myself. this time reading through, and I think it helps to redefine where we're going as a country and a world and what we are really looking for in authentic leadership today. So thank you, Tom, so much for being here today.
The honor is completely mine, and thank you for the opportunity. If I can help anyone, feel free to put my email up on the website.
Great.
And I love conversing with folks that, you know, either because they liked it or especially if they didn't, or if there's pushback, but say this. So the only reason to do anything that you and I do is to help someone. So if I can help any of your audience, I'll be happy to.
Great. And we will be posting this on social media, LinkedIn, and I'll have Dr. Tom Mayer's information, email and contact information available on his webpage too. So thank y'all for listening today, and we'll be in touch soon. Have a great week.